This episode is brought to you by Google Chrome. You think you know a browser, but Gemini and Chrome? That's new. It can help you with practically anything on the web, like restoring a vintage motorcycle from a 50-page restoration blog, or finally break down that long article you've had open for weeks. Gemini and Chrome is here for it. Ready to make anything online make sense? There's no place like Chrome. Check responses, setup required, compatibility and availability varies 18+.
I'm Ariana Brocious, and this is a special episode of Climate One. This week, Climate One is hosting a slate of events as part of SF Climate Week. We've got a series of live programs at the Commonwealth Club, featuring California and the San Francisco Bay Area's leading voices in policy, climate justice, and business. Today, we're giving you, our pod listeners, a sneak peek of one of these conversations. You'll hear more of these interviews in our regular episodes in the coming weeks. And if you're in the Bay Area, come join us in person. Check out climateone.org for a list of all of our programming during SF Climate Week. The state of California is working on an affordable and just energy transition. But how to get there is a big question with lots of nuance. Climate One co-host Greg Dalton spoke about this with Leanne Randolph, chair of the California Air Resources Board, and Mary Rose Taruk, energy justice director of the California Energy Justice Alliance. They had a live conversation taped at the Commonwealth Club World Affairs as part of our SF Climate Week programming.
So at the beginning of the Biden-Harris administration, former chair of the California Air Board, Mary Nichols, was on track. A lot of people thought she was going to be the head of the U.S. EPA. But that nomination was derailed by environmental justice advocates who criticized California's emission reduction plans because they focused on low-cost ways to reduce emissions. That focus often thought to be good politics and good economics, low-cost transition. But it meant that refineries could buy offsets in faraway places and not clean up their own communities, such as Richmond, that are overburdened with pollution. So Mary Rose, now that Leanne Randolph is chair of the California Air Board, how would you rate its record on environmental justice?
Wow. Starting out big.
Wow. Hello.
Let's get right to it, you know. We don't got much time. We got to get to the real thing, you know. We got to go quick on climate.
It's a friendly conversation, right?
Yeah, so as one of the directors at the California Environmental Justice Alliance, our relationship to climate solutions is about environmental justice, and it isn't just about greenhouse gases, but the communities that are impacted by the climate pollution. And so it was a struggle with the previous CARB chair to integrate community realities and the pollution realities into our climate policies and programs. And so I think that's where we butted heads and we're like, okay, how do we help environmental justice land well inside the agency? And so we now have environmental justice seats on the Air Resources Board. We have an environmental justice team inside staff. And so I think when you landed at the Air Resources Board, we had done some work already to help create a better relationship between environmental justice communities and the policies that were coming out of our climate agency, the Air Resources Board. And so I think I and many organizations in the environmental justice movement appreciate the more collaborative effort and the spirit that you've brought into the agency. And I think it's going better than the relationship that we had with the last chair.
So Leanne, that's meaningful. You know, how do you balance that low cost, which is really an issue these days, you know, the cost of this transition, with protecting the people who are historically marginalized communities? You know, can we have low costs and just transition? How do you balance those values?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that it's not just about low cost. It's really about making sure that this transition is affordable and accessible to everyone. And, you know, people like Mary Rose, who've been working for decades representing communities that are completely left out of the conversation, we have really tried to be as mindful as possible that we need to make sure that this transition is more available. So one of the ways we've done that, for instance, is reorienting our incentive programs so that they are not just available to everyone, but instead are targeted to low-income residents or communities that wouldn't otherwise have access to the technology.
Okay. So it's all of those things. Mary Rose, we're in a bad budget year. You know, the governor and the legislature are going back and forth. We're kind of in an in-between period right now. But how concerned are you that environmental justice programs will be on the chopping block? Because they're often some of the first things to get cut.
Yeah. One of the innovative programs that have come out of the environmental justice community is actually to create climate resilience centers across the state. You know, the wildfires and the floods and the different ways that our communities and the landscape in California has been devastated, we think there should be climate resilience centers everywhere so that, for instance, when PG&E cuts out your power, we have places to go in the community where there are microgrids and they have the power and electricity for us to plug in our phones or our medical devices so that we could still live and communicate with our loved ones. And so one of the things that have been on the chopping block on the state budget is to cut the climate resilience centers that we have fought for, that we've worked with state agencies on, like the Strategic Growth Council, that were on board. And it took a lot of effort to put those kinds of ideas and solutions into place. And then to see the governor and the legislature pull back their support for years of work for these kinds of programs that we need, especially the most vulnerable and climate impacted communities in the state. We need those things moving forward. And in a bad deficit year, what is our commitment for the future of these communities? There's also things on the budget that we think should be cut.
I was going to say, where would you cut? Yeah, okay. Governor Turok, where would you cut? Yeah.
Well, Governor Turok says, there. You know, so for instance, there's a hydrogen hype right now in the state of California, and Governor Newsom and others are promoting a hydrogen hub or development in California. Environmental justice communities and our environmental friends are saying, prove to us that hydrogen is not going to harm communities, that it actually adds to our solutions and not take away. For instance, we've been studying a lot of hydrogen. A lot of it is actually fossil fuel based. And if we already don't think that fossil fuels are causing climate change, then why are we promoting hydrogen? And so there's a big chunk of hydrogen funding that's still in the budget that we think could be better used for building decarbonization or climate resilience centers, et cetera.
Leanne, let's get you in on this. I know some of this is outside of the Air Board in terms of the state budget, but let's get you first on cutting environmental justice programs, resilience or otherwise, and then we'll get to hydrogen later.
It's really going to be kind of the legislature and the governor who are going to make these decisions. We're playing the long game here, right? So the budget goes up and down, and what we want to make sure is that we are continuing to move forward as much as we can, that we can continue to hold on to as much of the funding as we can, but also to the extent that we have any impacts on the climate commitment is to make sure that in the coming years, as the budget gets better, that we're first in line to get any funds that are delayed back. Many of our programs have been delayed and not cut. So that's encouraging that we'll be able to kind of, you know, revisit this in future years. And I also, you know, I'm going to sort of mention an area of disagreement we have with the environmental justice community, which is the importance of the market-based programs, because a lot of the funding that is available to make this transition does come from cap and trade and the low carbon fuel standard. And it is necessary that those programs continue to deliver the funds that allow us to deploy zero emission infrastructure, vehicles, appliances. The work we're doing to decarbonize the economy, you know, needs to come from many different places. And our market-based programs are one of the ways that we are able to kind of keep some of that funding going. And I think it's an important conversation that we always have to continue to have with communities, because we aren't always going to agree on everything, but frequently there are ways that we can adjust what we're doing to be more responsive to concerns and at least try you know, to get to some point of agreement, recognizing that we're not going to agree on everything.
So the cap and trade program sets a cap on emissions, and companies can kind of trade the right to pollute or pollution permits. And then low carbon fuel standard, you know, sets performance metrics for liquid transportation fuels. That creates this, you know, some of the money that comes from that goes into the greenhouse gas reduction fund to pay for programs. You know, Leanne Randolph, can that fund be rated in a budget year? Because we've had this history in this state where there is money collected, say, for the gasoline tax, and we have to put in a big lockbox with chains around it so that, you know, legislators can't get their fingers in there because they see a pot of money and they're like, ooh, honey. So can that be rated in a bad budget year?
So they have to be used for greenhouse gas reducing programs, and at least 40% of those funds have to be spent in statutorily defined disadvantaged communities. So it's not a separate little general fund that can be used for anything. It needs to be used for climate.
Okay.
And the environmental justice community was who won that law.
True.
Absolutely true. To dedicate at least 40% of those polluter funds, we think of them, to mitigate the climate pollution that's in communities like Richmond and West Oakland and South LA, et cetera.
Right. It was not set up that way originally by Governor Schwarzenegger, who was the first one to kind of put in these market-based mechanisms that the state had to be pressured to add those things through legislation and advocacy.
You're listening to a special SF Climate Week conversation between Greg Dalton and two guests, Leanne Randolph, chair of the California Air Resources Board, and Mary Rose Taruk, Energy Justice Director of the California Energy Justice Alliance. We'll have more after this quick break.
Hi, Diva. It's Rachel.
And Jordan. Yeah, hi. Quick question.
Why are you not spending your Venmo balance?
Yeah, we're concerned.
You can, like, buy stuff with it.
Ugh, you love buying stuff.
And earn cash back on eligible purchases.
Mm, you love purchasing eligible things.
So the money your friend sent you yesterday, that's today's ramen, or rideshare, or eye patches.
The skincare kind, not the pyro kind.
Spend with Venmo, and you can earn cash back with Venmo Stash. Venmo Stash bundle terms and exclusions apply. Max $100 cash back per month. See terms at venmo.me/stash terms. ID verification required to use a Venmo balance.
Leanne, researchers at the group Next 10 calculated that the state has reduced emissions on average about 1.5% a year between 2010 and 2021. There's so many numbers in this. You know, we're going to reduce emissions by X amount by year Y compared to some baseline. My head explodes. I can't keep track of all those things. I can keep track of 1.5% a year. And to reach our 2030 goals, we'd have to reduce emissions by 4.5% a year, basically 3x from what we've done so far. We've already done the easy stuff, right? Now the harder stuff comes. So how can we multiply by 3x emission reductions when we're getting to the harder work?
Well, so one of our responsibilities at CARB is to adopt the climate change scoping plan that gets updated every 5 years. And when we did our most recent update at the end of 2022, we were really clear that here's the suite of strategies, here are the things that need to happen, but unless they actually happen and unless the deployment happens, we will not reach our goals. So deployment is absolutely critical. We need the renewable energy that is going to support the transition to move as much as we can to electricity. Our market-based programs that mentioned earlier need to get more stringent. We are working on that right now. We are looking at both our low carbon fuel standard program and our cap and trade program, looking at how they can achieve more reductions. And we are continuing to consider our regulatory strategies. One thing that's important to recognize is that it's not just about the market-based programs. It's about the critical regulations that drive emissions reductions. It's about Advanced Clean Cars 2, 100% new car sales, zero emission by 2035. It's about advanced clean trucks and advanced clean fleets. Those rules together will transition the heavy duty sector to zero emission by 2045, with new sales being zero emission by 2036. And it's those rules that will really benefit communities that live along freeways, that live near ports, that live near the incredibly growing warehouse industry. And so
let me jump in there. Truckers say they can't afford it. Truckers say that electric truck, and I saw electric trucks driving to the LA recently. I was like, so excited. There they are, electric trucks on the road.
They're there.
Right. and they cost double of a diesel truck.
Right.
And so sounds great, but you know, unless you're going to pay truckers a bunch of money, you know, $250,000 to buy a truck that they could buy for $125,000, how's it going to happen?
Few things I would say. First of all, the cost will continue to go down. We are already seeing reductions in battery prices as we anticipated when we adopted the rule and considered the rates of adoption. That battery technology will continue to reduce in price. Incentives do help. The total cost of ownership is a really important conversation to have with people who are buying these trucks. You know, you have a higher upfront cost, but you have lower maintenance costs and lower charging costs, or lower fueling costs, I should say. So this is not a transition that's going to happen overnight. And it's really about the trends. And those trends aren't necessarily linear. You know, you will have some sectors that have breakthroughs and move forward, and then other sectors that are maybe going slower than you think they're going to go. The key is that we keep moving forward with all of our strategies, and we get the rules in place that ensure that the companies and industries will be making the transition and will continue to move forward. And I'm just going to say one more thing about that, which is the incredible support from the federal government. When we adopted our scoping plan, we did not model in the Inflation Reduction Act or the Infrastructure and Jobs Act because they were brand new and we didn't have time to put it into our modeling. So the way I think of those laws is they put wind in our sails. You know, we had a plan. We could show that that plan would reduce greenhouse gas emissions and still sustain a strong economy. And now we have even more support. And so that support from the federal government will also really help. They have heavy duty vehicle incentives as well.
Mary Rose, you know, most people who receive Amazon packages, come to the Commonwealth Club, listen to this show, don't live in a diesel death corridor or near a port or near a warehouse where there's a lot of concentration of diesel trucks. So tell us how important this getting away from diesel, which has many carcinogens, creates all sorts of health problems. How important is this?
So when, if my kids live next to the freeway and I'm spending multiple times a year taking them to the emergency room for exacerbated asthma, like what is the cost of like your child's health? You know, those are the types of ways that we approach these climate and environmental policies from environmental justice communities is from our health, the families of our, the health of our families. And so what will it cost for us to change our ways, this the polluting economy that we belong to? Like sometimes it does feel like really big to make that change and that transition. But here we are actually integrating our health ideas into climate and environmental policy. And this is why when we say we have to move from those diesel trucks, especially on the 880 in Oakland where I live, you know, the Flatlands communities in Oakland, for instance, don't have the same cleaner air as, say, the folks who are in the Oakland Hills. And
aren't trucks even banned on the 580?
Like they are, and that's an environmental racism situation.
What's up with that?
Yeah, it's environmental racism, and so we are trying to correct those kinds of policies and decisions that have been made in the past. And I think with California, majority more people of color who and legislators, state legislators who come and have grown up in environmental justice communities, this is why you're seeing climate laws and policies and programs actually take into account these kinds of win-win solutions that we need through our environmental agencies. And it's not just good for environmental justice communities, it's good for everybody when we reduce the pollution coming out of diesel trucks.
You've been listening to a special SF Climate Week conversation. You can find all of our Climate Week programming at climateone.org. Stay tuned to our pod feed for more episodes in the coming days. I'm Arianna Brocious. Thanks for listening.